Today's Teisho will be on Case 82 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 82 is entitled Tai Ryu's Indestructible Dharma Body. Engo's introduction. The fishing line at the end of the rod, the one with eyes will know, the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary, the enlightened one will discern. What then is the fishing line at the end of the rod and the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary? See the following. Main subject. A monk said to Tai Ryu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? Tai Ryu said, flowers cover the hillside right like brocade. The veil lies deep in the shade. Sicho's verse. The question came from ignorance. The answer was not understood. The moon is clear. The wind is cool. The wintry pine stands on the peak. I laugh heartily to hear the saying, when you encounter a man of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. He held up a crystal whip and smashed the jewels. Otherwise, faults develop. For there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations. So I want to thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen, on whether you're online or in person. And it's wonderful to see so many people here in person. This is like amazing. This might be a record for a post-COVID record. And I'm so glad you're here. It's wonderful to sit together any way we do it. So online is great. But, you know, in person, there's just something special about that, I think, you know. So thank you for coming one way or another, and those of you who are here in the flesh, thank you for being here. So this koan is, I couldn't not talk about this koan because, I have discovered that I don't have an indestructible body. You know, I have had really good luck in my life with health and but I have done something to my back, right? And I'm going to get an MRI on Tuesday, and I'm going to see a physical therapist. But after the sesshin, I was really riding high. That was such a great sesshin. And I was moving a bunch of heavy boxes, and then there was that day we had snow. I shoveled some snow. Something happened, right? So I've often gone to the pharmacy for this or that, and I've noticed that there are these giant bottles of like ibuprofen, you know, and like 300 tablets, and you think, who needs 300 tablets of ibuprofen? But apparently lots of people do, right? You know, as it turns out, I'm discovering this myself. I have found a really good physical therapist. I really think she's going to work wonders. And today when I started out, I was having so much pain. I really couldn't sit on this cushion. You know, I won't describe the pain in lurid detail, but it's pretty vivid. It's let me just say, you know. I now understand when people say they have shooting pain, I now know what that means, right? So it helped a lot to just meditate lying down, and I have not really done that, but I thought this is actually very effective, you know? This is working out pretty well. It was not comfortable, and there was a lot of discomfort there too. And strangely, when I got back on the cushion here, I was dreading this, but it's actually better than lying down in a lot of ways. So, you know, when we have experiences that cause us pain or suffering, you know, one way, or there's many forms of pain and suffering, right? not all of them are, you know, electricity shooting down your arm. You know, we, you know, I think on some level we want to be, you know, it's easy to create fantasies of omnipotence or, you know, power. So, you know, I know that, you know, I have a friend who who's well, it's my father, so I'm the friend, right? I was trying to do a hypothetical, but I won't do it. You know, my father grew up in an area of Newark where he was often the target of violence, right, growing up. And he, I think that haunted him. I think it made him want to be a powerful person, you know. I think he wanted to put himself out of the reach of that kind of violence. And I understand that. That makes a lot of sense, you know. You know, and when I look at what's happening to our country right now, you know, it's astonishing, really. I mean, when you look at what's happening in only 12 days, you know, what you see is, you may not share my politics, but what you see, what I see, is government being completely remade by these people who want, you know, sort of like absolute power or unlimited power, and are willing to do, you know, have worked very hard to get it and are very unprincipled and so on. And, you know, when you see that, you know, I mean, maybe you're different, but one might have fantasies, right? Like, if only I were Superman, you know, I would come down and I would punch Trump in the nose, you know, and I would throw these guys out, you know, if I had these superpowers. And, you know, that those kinds of fantasies of omnipotent power exercised on behalf of the good and not for evil are so attractive, right? So attractive. You know, in real life too, you know, you will sometimes see that our country, which sees itself in such positive ways, has done some terrible things, right? What I'm getting at, I guess, is that those fantasies of power in response to the experience of powerlessness are very human. You know, I understand, you know, my father growing up in Newark during the Depression, very difficult, a lot of inter-ethnic violence and things like that. I can understand why he grew up wanting to become powerful. You know, he was in the military. He was a very competitive, aggressive person, right? And I think he worked really hard to be a competitive, aggressive person. I think locked inside of that guy was actually kind of an easygoing person who just didn't think the world would tolerate his easygoingness. But, you know, those fantasies of power, of omnipotence, are very dangerous. Because, you know, actually Trump has those fantasies too. All of his henchmen have those fantasies. They don't see themselves as the evil guys and the evil henchmen. They see themselves as, I was reading this article. A lot of people in Trump's entourage are big fans of Lord of the Rings. Yes, it's true. They all are fans of Lord of the Rings, and they think that they're the good guys. You know, they're like, they're trying to save the Shire and the world from, you know, Sauron, right? And I guess they think Sauron is, you know, democracy or the Democratic Party or something. But, you know, Trump himself, they all are motivated by revenge fantasies. They all see themselves as victims, and they all want omnipotent power. And you know, I think that psychology is very widespread throughout the world. Maybe it's why right now all of these absolutist governments are taking over. you know, this is very highfalutin talk, and it's very far removed, but from, you know, everyday life maybe, although it's in the papers every day. But I think we all respond to challenges that way. When we experience a challenge, we want mastery. We want control. You know, we want to be on top of the situation, right? We don't want to be, you know, nobody wants to be beaten up. Nobody wants to be dominated, and so on and so on. So I think we, you know, on the macro level, it's pretty clear that people are taking over the country who want to be dominant, who want to get revenge against the people they feel have injured them. And they feel the way to do that is to acquire unlimited power. But I think we all kind of have that mindset. Maybe I'm alone in that regard. But, you know, contemplating, like, I have, you know, childish fantasies, you know, contemplating, you know, the idea of, you know, our invading Greenland, right? I find myself thinking sometimes, the world is so screwed up, I wish I had omnipotent power. I wish I could just, you know, make Trump disappear, or send him off to Azkaban, like in Rowling's novels, right? Like Harry Potter. Banish the Republican Party to Azkaban. So tempting to think that way. But you know, that's what's created the problem. Those guys all have the same, you know, the same fantasy of dominance, absolute power, and setting things to rights, right? So I just think this is the way we approach a lot of things in life. And also on the micro level, I think we are like this a lot too. We all want to have an indestructible body, right? We all want to be indestructible, you know. And I think that's a perfectly understandable thing, because, you know, so much in life causes us pain and suffering, causes us hurt, right? I myself had fantasies when I started practicing Buddhism of, you know, like, I thought maybe enlightened people were, like, in some way, I didn't think bullets would bounce off of them, but I thought in some way they were invulnerable, right, indestructible. You know, I really believed that, right? I mean, not rationally, but I think under the surface I felt powerless, I felt unhappy and vulnerable. And I don't think my only motivation for getting into Buddhism was my desire for an indestructible body. But I definitely wanted to be safe and secure, and I have to say powerful, in a way, powerful. And I think lots of people, again, maybe I'm wrong, lots of people have motivations like these, right? It's like, I'm confused, you know, the Dalai Lama doesn't seem confused. You know, I'm frightened. The Dalai Lama doesn't seem frightened. I'm powerless. Everybody the world over, they all revere the Dalai Lama, you know. So he's powerful in a way, right? And, you know, it's possible on some level to have some of that baggage rattling around in your head. It's possible to imagine somebody like the Dalai Lama, even though he's aging in front of our very eyes, as somehow, you know, immune to suffering or immune to these challenges. You know, I've talked about this before, but, you know, years ago, Genki Roshi hosted another Zen master from Japan who was dying of cancer. And that was a real education for me, because I guess on some level I really was imagining, and it's foolish, you know, but I was in some place in my mind I thought that, you know, once you were enlightened, you were free from pain, you know, and suffering, right? And then, you know, this guy was a really genuinely, deeply enlightened person, very respected, and a friend of Genki. He had trained with Genki at Daitokuji, they had gone to college, you know, in Japan. A lot of Zen priests go to college, you know, like Buddhist university. So the Soto Zen people have their own university. The Rinzai people have their own university. The Pure Land Buddhists have their own university. And actually, Webb Roshi used to teach at the Pure Land University, even though he was a Rinzai Zen priest. He had very good relations with the people there, and he used to teach there in the summers, you know. So Genki had gone to college with this guy, and they had both, you know, gone through all the standard training and become really distinguished Zen masters, as they say, Zen teachers. And you know, this guy was visiting his old friend because he was dying. And seeing this guy, you know, really in pain, you know, like real pain, and getting up and getting onto the cushion and being in pain on the cushion, you know, it was a real education for me. It was really, you know, childish fantasy is that, you know, the Dalai Lama doesn't feel pain, or Genki, you know, Genki Roshi didn't seem to feel pain. He could sit forever, you know, my beloved teacher. But, you know, this man was deeply enlightened and often just struggling with, like, elemental pain. And I myself have been struggling, not in the same way or not to the same degree, but, you know, with, you know, pretty impressive levels of pain. You know, I must have done something. I pulled a muscle, or maybe I've torn something. I don't know, but it's resting on a nerve. I know that. And, you know, at first it didn't seem that bad, but it's like as time went on, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, at certain moments, it's just like, I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable, but, you know, you just want to shut it off, right? It's so powerful. And you know, pain has that effect, right? It's like when it arises, you know, it's like everything else disappears. The world is gone, and you're just there with your pain. And, you know, pain in your legs can be pretty bad, but this is many times worse, I would say. It's like you're a little kid up against a big bully, right? Or like a monster. Like you're up against this overwhelming force that you can't do anything about. And of course, what you want to do is make it go. You want it to stop, right? But you can't. It won't stop, right? And then you can fall into despair. Right? You can fall into and panic, right? Oh my God, you know, this is going to eat me up. And that is where, that's I think where most people's encounters with pain stop, right? And I certainly had some moments like that in the last week and this morning too, right? But when I, you know, I sat down on the cushion, and when I started, that, you know, pain was just so strong. So I thought, okay, I'll cut myself some slack and I'll lie down on the floor over there. And that was also painful, but less so. And, you know, I had a chance in that posture to get into Mushin, right? It was like I had a little space, and I could just get into Mushin. And that gave me like a calm, centered place to deal with the situation. And it's like, thank God I know how to do that, right? It's thank God thank the Buddha, thank whomever, thank our teachers. But you get into that place, and the pain is still there, but now you have like a place to stand, right? It's that still point in the turning world, or still point in the burning world. And, you know, what we want to do is get out. I want out of this, right? Stop, right? But, you know, it doesn't necessarily stop. So then, you know, you could fall into despair. You could look for like a super duper, you could get off the cushion and run down to the drugstore and look for like a super duper pain reliever. But, you know, actually that, nobody likes to be in pain, but that situation is really an interesting situation. If you can just get a grip on yourself and realize, I was, or to put it differently, I was able to get a grip on myself and realize everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up, see? So, you know, of course you want to see this pain as the enemy, this overwhelming, powerful thing, right? But, you know, if you can just get to a place where it's calm, where you can get into empty mind, you know, you begin to use that pain to deepen your concentration. And we do that in Zazen all the time. But, you know, this morning I was able to, you know, use that pain to really get into deep mushin. It took me, you know, 5 sits, basically. The first couple of sits, I was just being helplessly thrown around the room. But, you know, like, at the end of that first session, I got up and I just walked around and then I went back down. And now it was possible, right, to get to that still point. And, you know, the pain just pushed me deeper and deeper into mushin. You know, and at some point, you know, it's like the pain is still there, but there's like this opening. It's like an opening. And you know, this is should be familiar to anybody who's done Zazen, right? It's like you just keep going into that emptiness, going into that emptiness, going into that emptiness, and the pain is pushing you. But at some point, it's like the stillness really becomes still and broad or widens out. And it's almost like, you know, pain makes you close up and close up. It's like your walls get tighter and tighter and tighter around you. But at some point, if you get deep enough into emptiness, it's like it opens up and you feel like it's like spacious, you know, spacious. And you know, that is where so many insights happen, right? That is where so many insights happen. Earlier in my life, I was very interested in Christian and Jewish mysticism when I was in college. And I remember reading about this Christian mystic named John of the Cross. And John of the Cross was arrested by a rival Catholic group, another order, and he was put in this little cell that he couldn't, the cell was so small he couldn't stand up and he couldn't stretch out. And he was there for like weeks on end. And that's when he had his experience of the presence of God, right? And totally transformed him. And I'm glad I wasn't in that box, you know? That would have been a horrible experience. But I can understand what happened to him. I think it was like this, right? Like this. You know, this is a different path, right? Different path. One path is to seek, you know, to dominate others or to seek power over others, right? And, you know, the other path, it seems to me, is this other way of relating to the world, right? It's like instead of trying to dominate what's threatening you or hurting you, you drop down into yourself and down into emptiness, and you push through your that you push into that emptiness deeply, and then there's like an opening. I really feel that this is the path of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, which we are studying in our sutra group, the Buddha says that in his previous life, he was, well, let me back up a little bit. In Buddhist thinking about the world, there have been multiple Buddhas. Those Buddhas existed long ago in prior universes, you could say. In that prior universe, there was a Buddha named Dipamkara. And Dipamkara was the Buddha of that particular universe, at that world age is what they're called in Buddhism, right? That particular world age. And there was a young man who would later become the Buddha, and he saw Dipamkara and fell in love with his wisdom, and he resolved to become a Buddha himself. Now, you don't have to become a Buddha. You can have Daikensho, and you can return to the source. It's like a wave returning to the ocean, and you're free. You know, if you vow to be a Buddha, it's a much more rigorous program of self-development, you could say. Because what you vow to do is to be reborn many times, each time you have a challenge that you have to deal with, and you are always putting the welfare of other beings ahead of yourself. So it's very rigorous, you know. If you're arhat or bodhisattva, you can just go on. But, you know, if you decide to be a Buddha, you have to go through many lifetimes of selfless service. So anyway, the Buddha had already gone through, meeting Dipamkara, resolved not to be an arhat or a bodhisattva, but to become a Buddha, and he pledged to do so. And Dipamkara prophesied that he would become a Buddha. So then the Buddha begins this long, long program of self-transformation, and eventually was reborn as Siddhartha Gautama in India, and so on. So anyway, the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra says, I was, in my previous life, I was a prisoner of the Raja of Kalinga, this very ruthless person. And he tortured me by cutting off my limbs, right? And he cut my limbs off one by one. And of course, no anesthesia, right? The Buddha says, if I had given way to hate even once at that moment, I would not have been reborn as the Buddha. See, I think what we're talking about there is these two paths, right? Whether we're talking about pain on the cushion, or political events that are deeply frightening and painful. I think the strategy is the same, the approach is the same. You know, the fantasies of omnipotence are deeply alienating for us, right? They cut us off from the world. You know, we have those fantasies, but actually, you know, the door to awakening is our vulnerability, right? Our fragility. You know, Buddha started out by saying, everybody's going to die, everybody suffers, everybody's going to get old. You know, this is so different from promising people eternal life in the glorious kingdom.
within, as it says in the Bible, indestructible bodies. The Buddha didn't say that. The Buddha said, you know, actually, your vulnerability is your superpower. Your vulnerability is your superpower. You know, you may be able to leap tall buildings at a single bound like Superman, but that actually doesn't help you. You know, what helps you is being in that place where you feel powerless. And then you have a choice, right? You can, you know, have the fantasy of omnipotent power, which means removing yourself from the real world and from all worlds. And, or you can become one with the situation, right? And the Buddha, when he was being tortured by the Raja of Kalinga, chose the latter and became the Buddha, right? You know, it's so interesting. During the session, I think I talked a bit about Xu Yun. Xu Yun was the greatest Zen master of the last 300 years. And he lived until the Mao period. He was born just around the time of the Civil War, believe it or not. There are records of his birth. And he actually was an old man, very famous Zen master during the Cultural Revolution, during the Mao, those terrible period in Chinese history. And he was a famous figure in the Buddhist world, and he was arrested by these Red Guards. And he's like 103 or something at the time, and they started beating him up. And this is well documented. And he went into deep samadhi. And one of the guards said, you know, I began to think, who is this guy? What am I doing? I'm doing a terrible thing, right? You know, that scene haunts me, right? Because it's like your vulnerability is your superpower. You know, your ability to make people disappear with your finger snap, that doesn't help anybody. You know, I mean, I think that for this guard, beating Xu Yan up was like, it's like, you know, he saw this person's wisdom and was ashamed of what he was doing. You know, I think this is how Gandhi defeated the British Empire, you know, basically. He shamed the British by being such an exemplary, kind, generous and person. And I think he was genuinely like a saint. You know, he cultivated that empty, expansive mind. And, you know, it was clear to people who knew him that he was like this, right? And I think it made people think twice about their power-hungry behavior, you know. So you know, whether we're on the cushion or we're in the world of crazy politics, you know, I think this is the path. You know, it's certainly true, you know, that things could get a lot worse politically, right? You know, we have no idea where all of this is going. And at the same time, there's all this other bad news, right? There's all this other bad news, you know. So, you know, I get a lot of magazines from, you know, the Natural Resources Defense Council, you know, all of these Sierra Club, and it's like bad news, species disappearing, and so on, and. It's like encountering something that's so painful and seems so powerful, right? And I think if you are locked into that situation, it's very destructive, right? Because, you know, you either withdraw from the world or you're trapped in this, in your own fantasies of revenge or anger, right? And we all have that same relationship to pain, right? You know, years ago, I was teaching meditation at Princeton. We had a group that met on campus in Princeton. Somebody in Princeton invited me at the time to teach meditation at this place called the International Center. It doesn't even exist anymore. It was torn down. But I would go over there on, I think, Tuesday nights and do meditation. And I was so surprised, you know, we would sit for two periods of meditation, and more than a number of times, the people who would leave would be mad. It's interesting, you know, it never happened at Rutgers. Rutgers students would say, that was wonderful and never come back, which that's sort of the Rutgers style, right? They say, that was fantastic, you've changed my life, and I'd never see him again, right? But the Princeton people were different, right? They would get mad. I'd say, how was your sit? And they'd go, you know, they'd look at me like they wanted to punch me. And I don't mean to sound, there's a class dimension to this. I can't help but saying it, right? I think these are very entitled people. And I think when they encounter, you know, they're sitting on the cushion and they're told don't move and they are having pain in their legs, I think they get mad. It's like, how dare you? How dare you inflict pain on me, right? You know, maybe that's not fair. But there was this difference. I noticed that people would get really mad, and I think that that experience of radical vulnerability, radical fragility, right? I think it was offensive to them because it pointed to something that they didn't want to see about themselves, right? I think it pointed to something they did not want to see about themselves, which is that you're fragile and you're human and nobody has all this power, because our existence is entirely produced by what the Buddhists call dependent origination. You know, without grass, no oxygen. Without trees, no oxygen. You know, you aren't the universe. You know, my wife, she really gets a lot of exercise. She eats well. She has a really healthy diet. It's really great. You know, as most of you know, 2 years ago she was having some vision problems, and it turned out she had a brain tumor, right? And it was like, wait, but I was doing everything right, you know. And she said that whole period was like, it was like unreal. It was like a dream. When she thinks back on it, it's like a dream, right? It was just such a departure from her regular life. And we're so lucky that the surgeon was, able to, it was a 7.5 hour operation and got the tumor out and all is well. But, we hate to admit it, but we're all like that, right? We're all like that. It's just, we can take care of ourselves, we can do all the right things, but one little thing, right? Sandy knows that there was this woman, there was a young Irish woman, I think her name was Maura O'Halloran, and she got one of these things, right? I think she read some book on Buddhism and thought, this is it. And she actually went to Japan and she studied with this very famous Soto Roshi. And she was one of these people who has just, unusual in her lack of obstacles to waking up. And she studied with him for just a couple years, right? And she had her Daikensho experience. There's a book about this, about her. She's fascinating. But anyway, her teacher said, we all thought she was going to be the next Dogen. You know, her aunt, when she would respond to her koans, it was just like, and he said, but, she finished the training season and she went on vacation in Thailand and she was crossing a street and she got killed by a bus. So, we have this fantasy, right? Enlightened people don't get hit by buses, the Dalai Lama, he's invulnerable, but that radical vulnerability, we want to deny it. We want to say, you know, it's so human to want to deny that because we're afraid. But if we make the secret weapon of our vulnerability is our ability to drop down into, is to be small and to drop down into that emptiness, right? And stay in that deep, deep place until everything opens up. And that opening up is actually connectedness, right? Pain makes us withdrawn to ourselves. And it locks us into a like defensive posture. It's so true, right? And you know, it's hard to get out of that. It's almost impossible to get out of that unless you can drop into that emptiness. Because, you know, pain undermines our trust. It, trust the process. And now I have cancer, or now I have this searing pain in my arm, you know. What kind of process is this, right? And you withdraw, it makes you smaller and smaller and more rigid and more rigid. And then you go into that emptiness and it's like you go down, 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 and then suddenly there's like an opening. And that's where that's the trusting mind comes back, right? Now my arm is screaming at me, but I'm so happy, really, seriously. And I feel so connected to everything around me. That's worth any price. And that's the path. That's the path. So you know, the indestructible body is not the body that we create by going to the gym. I'm not criticizing people going to the gym, by the way. Going to the gym and pumping iron and so on. You know, I see why people would like that, but I often sometimes think that that's a response to feeling powerless, right? Maybe I'm wrong, and if you like to lift weights, I'm wrong, okay? But let's just speculate. It could be true also that, you know, some bodybuilding culture has to do with a fear of vulnerability. It's possible. Maybe that's just envy on my part, because I don't have any muscles. But it's like you know, making yourself strong is a way of resisting, you know, these forces that are so menacing. And you know, the idea of creating an indestructible body, you know, that's a very power, you know, like Superman or all the Marvel CMU people, right? You know, one guy's actually cloaked in iron, right? He's vulnerable, but he's covered with titanium, actually. Iron Man has a titanium suit. And, you know, these people have their vulnerabilities, but they have superpowers. But the vulnerabilities, you know, that's the superpower. You know, those other things are actually get in the way sometime, right? They get in the way. So we all have that craving for superpower, and if you're lifting weights, please don't stop. I'm not criticizing. The real indestructible body, see, is the one you encounter when you go down into emptiness, and then there's this opening and spaciousness and connectedness. See, and now you're not in a defensive posture. Everything around you is your body. Everything is your body. The world is your body, see. Everything is your body, you know. And that is the indestructible Dharma body. That's the body, right, that this koan is talking about. And, you know, telling you the answer to the koan doesn't help, because you have to find your own indestructible Dharma body. When you go through this process, you're going to come out somewhere. Where do you come out? And that's what I'll want to hear, see. The fishing line at the end of the rod, the one with eyes, will know. The spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary, the enlightened one will discern. So look, Zen practice is so much like fishing, right? I myself, I've been a vegetarian for 50 years, so I don't fish. But you know, I used to fish when I was a kid, you put something on a hook and you throw it in the water and you can't make a fish appear, right? You keep trying to find a fish, but there's so much uncertainty in the process. You can't control the process. Fishermen will come back and say, got nothing today, right? Nothing today. They weren't biting and so on. Those are cliches, right? A lot of Zen practice is like that, right? You have to get on the cushion. You have to be on the cushion, right? Or nothing will happen. But you can't make anything happen. That in itself is like coming face to face with your vulnerability. You know, the idea that you're going to sit on, you know, so much of mindfulness is just terrible crap, if I may say so. You know, it's all about controlling your mind. I sit down and I get calm no matter what, you know, and it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't be calm. Has that ever occurred to you? You know, maybe calm is not appropriate in this moment. You know, calm is appropriate in some moments, but in other moments, not so appropriate. How do you know what's appropriate, right? So, you know, the idea of controlling your mind, that seems like a really, if I may say so, small-minded aspiration. You know, whatever arises is what has to arise, and whatever arises is my true nature. Everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping. So if the fish aren't biting, helping me wake up. It's not a failure of my technique, right? I could get a different lure, but it's not a failure of my technique. It's the manifestation of reality, of the Dharma body. And when you say, this is helping me wake up, but how? I don't know yet. I have a lot of pain in my arm. How is this helping me? See, how is this helping me? I don't know. I've got to discover how this is helping me. See, that's not delusion. That's the path, right? You know, I don't know how this is helping me, but it is. And then you go down into yourself and you go into that emptiness and you experience it now in a different way. So many people say, this misfortune was the best thing that ever happened to me, right? You hear that all the time. They discover this. Okay. So a lot of Zen practice is like fishing. It's like you throw the line in and you wait, and nothing may bite and something may bite, but you can't control the process, right? The spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary, it's not about catching fish. It's not about fish. It's about this process, right? What then is fishing line at the end of the line, at the end of the rod? See the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary. A monk said to Tairiyu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? Tairiyu says, you know, basically, the whole world is your body. Flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. Secho's verse, the question came from ignorance. The answer is not understood. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it's understood or not. Everything is helping me wake up. The moon is clear. The wind is cool. The wintry pine stands on one peak. I laughed heartily to hear the saying, when you meet a man of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. Why would he laugh heartily at that? When we finish today, everybody's going to bow, three bows, right? That's one way to meet a person of the way, right? You know, one way is to say, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this. Another way is to bow. See, that's one way to meet a person of the way, is with a deep bow. He held the crystal whip and smashed the jewels. Otherwise, faults develop. For there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations.